Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, your weekly podcast that is this time 3 weeks. Well, it's still weekly. Why do I call it a weekly podcast when it's twice a week? I'm your host, Margaret Killjoy, and I talk about cool people who did cool stuff on my podcast called Cool People Did Cool Stuff. And I have Mia Wong with me as my guest. Hi, Mia.
Hello. I am, I said I was excited for the last time I was on this show. I am even more excited for this one. Oh, God.
I ruined what it was going to be about because I asked Mia to be part of a six-parter, and I was like, I can't not tell her. Also in on the loop is my producer, Sophie. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Mia's here.
Yeah.
Yay!
Mia is the host of It Could Happen Here, which is a daily podcast about things that could or could not happen here, wherever you're listening.
Every time I hear that we have a daily podcast, I'm like, why did we do that?
Yeah, that sounds stressful.
I'm like, that's a lot of work. And then I'm like, oh, wait, we did agree to do that, didn't we? Don't do a daily podcast, friends.
The fun thing about it is that, so I've been doing this for about almost 3 years now, mm-hmm. and the number of episodes I have done exceeds the episode count of entire, like, decade-long running shows, because you just do so many of them.
That's exactly true. Like I genuinely feel, because of the amount of content we put on Cool Zone Media, that we're just absorbing and spreading so much information to people that, like, the its quality despite the quantity, and that's why we're so cool. Wow, it's just like paragraph of bragging. Can we move on?
Yeah. Also really good at their job is Danil, our audio engineer. Everyone has to say hi to Danil.
Hi Danil.
Miss you.
Our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. And here's something that I'm surprised none of us have talked about sooner. Mia, have you ever heard of revolution?
No, unfamiliar with the term. Isn't that when the hand on the clock goes around in a circle?
Yes, and it can only go clockwise, not Widdershins. That's
Widdershins.
This metaphor
is that what
didn't.
It's called?
That's what it's called when you are really into witchy bullshit.
Aha!
Yeah. Sunwise and Widdershins. Those are, but that metaphor doesn't hold up. Well, I guess you could have a right wing and left wing. We are today talking about a whole lot of Russian revolutions in a short period of time. Like, we're going to talk about four of them over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks. We are going to talk about the Russian revolutions, the ones you've heard of, plus a few others that were part of the ones that you've heard of. And we're going to talk about how they were hijacked by a few power-hungry authoritarians, and about how a pluralistic group of rebels who actually cared about socialism fought like hell to live up to the famous slogan of the Russian Revolution, all power to the Soviets. I suppose here it's worth pointing out that Soviet means workers' council, like a decentralized bottom-up decision-making body that would be the center of a communist society. The crux of this story is the story of the Kronstadt Rebellion, when a bunch of sailors in an island fortress declared that, whether the Bolsheviks liked it or not, the actual promised revolution was going to happen. It was going to be politically pluralist, it was going to be bottom-up, it was going to be democratic, it was going to be full of freedom and equality, and they had an awful lot of guns and artillery with which to back up that particular position of theirs. They wanted a society where power resided in the actual Soviets, not in political parties. That was their kind of core demand, was that it's not about one political party ruling things, but instead a democratic, horizontal society. These sailors from Kronstadt were the shock troops of the revolution, and they had been for years. They were some of the best fighters who had just won two revolutions in a row and a whole-ass civil war. They worked in coordination with the workers in nearby St. Petersburg who were being killed for strikes and labor organizing. And in classic cool people who did cool stuff form, they didn't win. The entire 20th century and onward would look drastically different they had.
There's a line from, oh God, some episode of Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast where he's talking about this, where there's a line from one of the Bolsheviks where he says, we will be our own Thermidor, in reference to the Thermidorian reaction that ended the sort of high revolutionary period of the French Revolution.
Yeah.
And I think about that all the time, because the Bolsheviks leadership was literally just said, we are going to do the counter-revolution. And then they did it. And then they rewrote history. I think everyone would forget that they did it.
That is one of the main things I keep running across as I've been researching these episodes, which I'm not even done researching. I'm like, I've researched today's topics, but I keep running across them being the people who created the counter-revolution, the Bolsheviks, who probably need no introduction, but were the party that became the Communist Party and ruled the USSR for an awfully long time. Yeah, so many of them were so completely aware of exactly what they were doing by becoming the counter-revolution. And some of them even called it ahead of time, like Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, who we'll talk about more later, was like, oh yeah, in 1904, before the 1917 revolution, he was like, oh, well, if we do it this way, it's going to lead to, and then he described exactly what went wrong with the Russian Revolution.
Yep.
And then he just did it anyway. But if the Kronstadt sailors had won, there would be no moral leg to stand on in the West to condemn Soviet communism, because it would have been communism. It would have been a stateless society of free equals. The Kronstadt sailors didn't win. They fought like hell. For each Kronstadt soldier who died, 10 of their foes died first. A good chunk of them got away across the ice to Finland, and in the end, they lived vaguely free for many years. Their battle forced the Bolsheviks to lighten up on their authoritarianism just the slightest bit for a little while. Just something. But it's a tragic story. The collapse of the Kronstadt Rebellion was the collapse of the Russian Revolution. It was the final nail in the coffin for the fight for actual socialism. Like a lot of our stories, it's only a victory in that it's a victory of the human spirit. People will always be ready to fight for liberty, for free speech, and for economic equality. So, I'm going to tell you the story about the Kronstadt sailors. In order to do that, I'm going to tell you the story of the Russian Revolution. And while I'm at it, I'm going to tell you the story of the revolution that came before the Russian Revolution, and then the revolution that came before that, because there was a lot of them. And in order to do that, I'm going to tell you about the country it happened in, Russia. Huh?
Are we going back to the Mongols, or is it too?
Oh, we're starting before the Mongols.
Oh, pre-Mongols! Yay!
We're starting with Vikings.
Woo!
I'm going to fast forward through most of Russian history, but I like taking this little big picture view the first time I cover a country more in depth. You know, if you want to hear more,
do you like context, Margaret?
I do.
Oh, wow.
I do like context.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. And I never knew that about you.
Yeah, context the show. That's
context
my show.
That did context stuff.
Yeah. People who did cool stuff to help other people do cool stuff so that we might do cool stuff is actually kind of the point. So the idea of Russia goes back to around the late 800s, depending on you could just, I mean, there's been people living there for a very long time, right? And so it all depends on how you're counting. The story of Russia actually starts in Ukraine, or rather the city of Kyiv, currently the capital of Ukraine. In 882, a Viking guy named Oleg captured Kyiv and united northern and southern Slavs under his rule, Slavs being the ethnic group that was already living there, in what was known as Kievan Rus. And in this society, the Norse Vikings were the aristocracy, like the ethnic groups from elsewhere were kind of in charge. Eventually, they sort of assimilated 100 years ago. By 988, they go formally Christian. Kievan Rus lasted until the Mongols invaded 1237 to 1240. And I think that history, like, I think that Western history doesn't talk enough about the Mongols.
No, really. I mean, this is one of the, I don't know. The Mongol invasions are really interesting because there's, you get like two very, very, well, not very different, but you get two written accounts of it from very, very different civilizations. You get accounts from the various Chinese dynasties all getting destroyed. And then you also get the Islamic world accounts. And both of them are just like, oh my God, this is the worst thing that has ever happened. Running around screaming. And then the Western accounts of it are like, yeah, there are trade routes now. And it's like this was literally the apocalypse for entire civilizations.
Right.
And then like everyone, all the modern historians are like, oh yeah, but like you could move food from one side of the world to the other. It's like, oh boy.
Okay, but how much of that is the fact that like Europe was kind of a backwater as compared to places like the Islamic world and China, which were like the centers of actual civilization and things like that. So,
Definitely a lot of it.
So maybe Europe was like, oh, thank God we have roads. I don't know. It probably was pretty bad to get invaded by the Mongols. And one of the things that I didn't realize when I was younger about the Mongol invasion is it wasn't that they just like kind of came and then killed everyone and then left. Like the area that is now Russia was, there's a word for this. They had to give money to the Mongols for hundreds of years. There's a word here. I don't remember. Vassal. It was a vassal state. The main thing you'd call Russia at this point after the invasion of the Mongols in 1237 is the Grand Duchy of Moscow. And it is a vassal to the Mongols, which they slowly start beating back over the course of centuries. Ivan II did most of the hard work of beating back the Mongols, and this Ivan hated Catholics, so he set up kind of a curtain between Russia and the West. As best as I can tell, this is kind of where that idea that Russia is like not Europe really starts coming in. His kid, Ivan III, was also named Ivan the Terrible. He was not a great man. He set up the Tsardom in 547. Mr. the Terrible got his name because he killed everyone who disagreed with him. There's a lot of like very Russian stuff that is still true today that has been true for hundreds of years. And one of them is this like autocrats love Russia, you know?
Yeah.
And the other is that the way that Russia is going to solve like all of its war problems forever is by having really bad guns, really bad coordination, and just tons and tons of people and a complete lack of care for the lives of those people. But by 1613, you get Mikhail Romanov. Just, I didn't look up, it's spelled Michael, but I don't think it's Michael. And he's the first Romanov dynasty guy. The Romanovs are going to rule until 1917. And that's going to be shattered by this week's protagonists, bringing down 300 years of Romanovianism, which is totally a word. Under the Tsars, Russia really gets going. They're conquering Siberia like it's their own Wild West, which means that they're subjugating indigenous people as they go east. They're taking chunks of what's now Western Ukraine and Poland and Finland and what's now the U.S. I think that people in the U.S. don't quite, on some level, I think people know, like, oh yeah, didn't they used to have Alaska? But they also had a bunch of Hawaii and a fort in Sonoma County, California. Do you know that?
I think I knew about California. I didn't know they were in Hawaii.
That's only wild. Know the real surface level of that part of the story. As in, I read one sentence that said that. That's all I know about their Hawaiian.
That's so nuts.
I know more about their Alaskan and Californian thing.
Yeah, I feel like the thing with Russia is that, okay, so like one of the things that a lot of people have become very good at recognizing what an empire looks like when it looks like the British Empire, where, yeah. Okay, so the British Empire has all these colonies, but then people look at Russia and go, oh, this is one state. And it's like, no, this is a land empire. This is an older kind of empire, but people don't recognize it and don't recognize like the extent to which they just sort of marched east and then also like went through Alaska and
Yeah. No, you're right. It's because it's contiguous. People are like, oh, well, all that's Russia, as if, and I mean, every country, every single state in the world is on some level this, right? Like England isn't just the Angles, you know, like it was created. Absolutely. Russia is such a good example of this, like what gets looked at as internal colonization, but it wasn't internal at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, they just pushed through. I mean, it's the thing with China too. Like you get these land empires that, and China's later than most because I mean they're still like they invade Tibet in the 40s.
Yeah,
but yeah, people just don't. I don't know. There's something about the sort of seeming solidity of nation state borders that projects their legitimacy back to make people forget that like no, they just conquered these places and killed the people there.
Totally. And actually, even like when I was like, wow, they had Alaska and part of California, the reason it like blew my mind, on one level, it was like, oh, because it's the US. But the other is that, it's where it wasn't contiguous, right? But it was just, they're like, well, we're just going to keep going east. And they're like, oh, there's some water. And they're like, well, let's get on a boat and keep going east, you know? And it also is really useful to think about because like, I think the average American listener is more aware of indigenous populations in North America as indigenous populations, but it's the same thing that they are doing as they march east through Siberia and then they get to Alaska and they absolutely fuck up and kill indigenous people there, right? They used Alaska as a fur trade center until they depleted the population of bears and sea otters and wolves and foxes to where it wasn't profitable anymore. So they sold it to the U.S. in 1867 for the modern equivalent of $157 million. They fought indigenous peoples all along the eastward expansion, and those people fought back. And Russia was also constantly fighting the Ottoman Empire to the south, slowly gaining territory. Russia becomes the largest country in the world, which it remains. It is the largest country in the world, not by population, but by landmass. By 1721, the capital moves from Moscow to St. Petersburg. And this country, this powerful empire, it is huge and powerful, so powerful I used powerful three times total in this sentence. And it is generally seen as kind of backwards. It is very agricultural, partly because, do you know the reason it stayed agriculture is because they didn't get the potato for a really long time?
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Like, because it's like not really the best. I mean, obviously they grow a lot of wheat, especially in Ukraine area, right? But like overall, like you're talking about like a lot of like kind of rugged terrain, right?
Yeah, this is like yak grazing land, but it's not like, it's not great.
Yeah, and so potatoes, if you want to be like sedentary and grow crops, the almighty potato is the like way that you do it. And they didn't get it until a little bit later, right? Because it's an import from the New World, you know? And so they had to grow a ton of food in order not to starve all the time. They kept trying to modernize and westernize, like when the Tsar Catherine the Great, who cooed her own husband to take power in the mid-18th century. I don't actually know a ton about her yet, but... And it stayed autocratic as fuck for years, and most of the modernization didn't trickle down to the peasants. Russia always had a huge army relative to its population, poorly trained and armed, and their strategy was leaders throw poorly armed conscripts at the problem until the problem is solved. This was true for the Tsars, and it's going to be true for the Bolsheviks. It is, as people point out, one of the strategies that defeated the Nazis. I think that there could have been other strategies that could have been utilized.
Yeah.
We've talked more about Russia in the 19th century in one of our first episodes about the nihilists and, of course, about its folklore a bit in our episodes about Baba Yaga. So if you want, you can go back and listen to those. But in the 19th century, there's a whole bunch of groups that are like, what if not autocracy, though? And one of the ways that they're going to express their disinterest in the Romanov dynasty is by shooting, stabbing, and exploding their rulers. Also, interestingly, none of them map up to like the Western leftist socialist positions at the time. These groups we are talking about, they are not Marxists and they are not anarchists. They are inspired by both of those groups, especially the anarchists, but they're social democrats with knives. Or some of them are like centrists. And to be a centrist when you live under a czar, you kind of got to go to war against the czar.
Yeah.
Like the center right has to go to war against the czar.
Yeah.
The center right is actually going to kick off the 1905 revolution, but we'll talk about that in a minute. The crisis of Russia in the 19th century, according to most people who lived there, was that everyone was poor and starving and authoritarian rule sucks. And specifically, the freedom of the serfs didn't actually make their lives better enough. The crisis of Russia, according to history books, is the crisis of modernization. They weren't good at modernizing, and when they did, modernization challenged autocratic rule because modernizing meant now you have new social classes. Like you have a middle social class and you have the intelligentsia and you have students and you have an industrial urban proletariat and all those other troublesome classes. Also, you have all the angry peasants who are no longer serfs but don't have any access to land. But you know how they could have made their lot better, Mia?
Buying potatoes?
From our sponsor, we're coming full circle, the Almighty Potato, our only sponsor. And if you don't want to buy it, grow your own. They're great.
I think I got a potato ad on here one time. It was very happy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
People have messaged me saying that.
I'm here for it. Host Red ad. Don't necessarily buy potatoes that you don't want, but growing potatoes and the concept of potatoes, real interesting. Although when I first started this podcast, I didn't know quite as much about how deep the potato goes. So here's ads for potatoes.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
And we're back.
We've emerged from the potato hole.
Yeah.
It goes way down.
Yeah. Well, you just have to build up. You stack up the dirt on top of the potato. You build the hole. That's a little potato gardening advice with Margaret, who has not eaten any potatoes she's grown, even though she's tried several times. But that's because she doesn't stay home long enough to harvest her crops. She travels too much. They live alone. Anyway, so the 19th century is coming to an end, and there's a revolution to foment, and you have people who want to do the fomenting. By the dawn of the 20th century, you start getting a bunch of the major players, and so we're going to talk about them, and we're going to start with the one that doesn't have a Western analog. We're going to start with the least understood group, the SRs.
Ah, yes.
The Socialist Revolutionaries. Doesn't it sound simple? You hear the name.
Yeah, and then you try to figure out what the difference between a left and a right SR is, and it's like...
Oh, yeah.
What?
I love reading history books from this time, because they'll be like, the moderate wing of the anarchists, and then the extremist wing of the anarchists, or even the right wing of the anarchists and the left wing of the anarchists. And when they say that, they don't mean right wing like we have a right wing now. It wasn't like ANCAPs. It wasn't anarcho-capitalists. It was like the anarchists who didn't want to kill everyone, or like the anarchists who were kind of liberal or whatever, you know? The SRs, it sounds like they'd be simple. They're the revolutionary socialists, because they're socialist revolutionaries, right? But they don't, like we've been saying, they don't map to a traditional Western understanding of this. They grew out instead of a different group. They grew out of a 19th century revolutionary tradition, the Narodniks. And we talk about them more on the Nihilist episode. I really kind of like them. Like, not necessarily like, oh, their ideological theory is like the best ideological theory or whatever. But like, they're the eco-hippies. Like, they're nice. I don't know if you have another.
It's funny because the one sentence description that I always see is people just call them populists. And it's like, that tells you literally nothing about what they actually believe. Like,
no. Calling them eco-hippies is a better way to describe them.
Yeah.
I think. They were agrarian socialists, which meant they were very specifically not Marxists, because Karl Marx, for all his, he fucking hated peasants. That's what I'm going to say about Karl Marx. The Narodniks were basically these student hippies who decided to go be among the people. So that's their like populism, right? Populist is a meaningless word. It can be used for everything. And they're heavily inspired by a whole bunch of different people, including, I believe, Peter Kropotkin and Bakunin, but also a whole lot of non-anarchists. Those are two big anarchist theorists that we're going to talk about in a little bit. And they're inspired by all these people, and they're like, okay, we're going to go out among the people and live there and talk about revolution and talk about like collectivizing and, you know, all these things. And going to the people to educate them about socialism and revolution didn't quite work. But the way it's usually described is this abject failure, and it wasn't an abject failure. It was a complicated mix. After the serfs had been freed in 1861, they were basically cast unceremoniously into the maws of capitalism. The Narodniks were like, Well, what if we keep the communes that you all were using, like, to feed yourself under when you were serfs, but just get rid of the noble who owns you? Like, what if instead of falling now into capitalism and splitting up the land and no one can has enough good land to eat, you keep the system that kept you fed and then you just get rid of the thing that was siphoning off all your food, the noble. But most of them are middle and upper class kids, and going to the people didn't necessarily win people over en masse. But a ton of them just like realized they liked peasant life and stuck around. And also whenever you're like, oh, they were like hippies or whatever, or like the state hunted them just absolutely like spread out across the country being like, are you all harboring hippies? You know? And there's all kinds of stories of peasant villages banding together to defend their hippie transplants.
Aww.
Yeah, there's like
that's really sweet.
A whole they're like, no, that guy taught me how to read. I'm not giving him
up.
Like, that's our doctor. Why would we tell you where he is? One thing that came out of the Narodniks are the nihilists, who are basically social democrats who like bombs an awful lot. And they came out of a kind of hipster class. It's like they sort of came out of the Narodniks and they sort of came out of this group that was like called the Nihilists, but wasn't quite what the Nihilists became. Like the Nihilists started off as like a like beatniky kind of thing. And then they were like, instead of just being a counterculture, they were like, okay, now we're serious hardened revolutionaries. Much like how the 60s, 1960s culture, counterculture like gave way to the early 70s, you know, committed revolutionaries in the United States. The exact same thing happened in the 1860s and 1870s in Russia. The nihilists eventually killed the vaguely progressive Alexander II in 1881. And so Alexander III took power and was like, well, I'm a fucking autocrat. Fuck all of you. Fuck westernizing. Fuck democracy. Fuck free speech. Fuck all the ethnic minorities. We are obsessed with Russification. And in particular, can you guess what ethnic minority they particularly hated?
Are they anti-Semites?
They are. They hated the Jews.
Oh, God.
Which is a long tradition in Russia.
Yeah.
Alexander the Third, he died young, but sadly he died of illness and not of justice. The other thing that came out of the Narodniks, and the reason we went on this a whole long tangent, is that the SRs came out of the Narodniks. They formed in 1901 or 1902. I have read both from the Neo-Narodniks, which were the group of people being like, man, those people sure had it right. And then people were like, not only do they have it right, but we should form a revolutionary organization and start trying to get some shit done. They're agrarian socialists who aren't Marxists. They want to overthrow the Tsar and redistribute land to the peasants. And you know what the most annoying things about, there's a lot of annoying things about leftism. One of the annoying things is the split between the worker, by which people mean the proletariat, aka someone who works in a factory or whatever in a city, and then the peasants. And famously, Marx kept assuming peasants were all reactionaries and right wing. I think this is fairly easy for the modern listener to understand. Think about how modern liberals assume that all poor rural people in America are MAGA Trump supporters.
Yeah, I think they're also like part of it, too, is all of these people, everyone down the line, every single one of these people who's going to be in this revolution or like all of this sort of intelligentsia people. This is Marx, too, are like haunted by the French Revolution. And in the French Revolution, like there are a lot of like, you know, like the thing that they're haunted by is like this image of like Paris standing alone as like the lone revolutionary city in this like whole nation of reactionaries. And it's like it was never quite true, but it's what shapes the way that they all think about this.
That makes sense. And like, you know, all of the class analysis that Marx did, and Marx did a lot of good work as an economist, I will give him that. And the class position of a peasant is very different than the class position of a proletarian worker. Like their relationship to the means of production is fundamentally different. And I can see why he got the idea that there was therefore something intrinsic to that relationship that made them right wing. But you have this thing, like the Paris Commune, friend of the pod, one of the first episodes we did, you go back and listen to it. We haven't done the French Revolution yet. I have to find people I like in it.
Yeah, it's hard.
Like a bunch of assholes killed a bunch of other assholes and then killed each other. Somewhere along the way, there was a bunch of really good meaning people, actually. And at some point, I need to just do the fucking Enlightenment and all that shit. But I kind of, whatever. Anyway, during the Paris Commune, you have this thing too, right? Where the Paris Commune stood alone, but they didn't. There were other communes in other smaller cities. And one of the things that happened was Bakunin and a bunch of anarchists and other people, I actually don't know if Bakunin was an anarchist here at this point. No, I think he was. Went to, I think, Lyon, but I'm not sure off the top of my head. They went to a smaller area and they were like, we're going to organize people. What was it? Was it Marseille?
It might have been Marseille. I vague memories of being Marseille. I could be completely wrong about that.
Yeah, I don't know. And Marx was like, fuck you. Don't go to those, you know, the peasants are all reactionary. You can't organize them. And I've had conversations with, like, one of my friends feels firmly that this is the reason that Paris stood alone and therefore was not able to succeed, you know, was that this idea of writing off everyone else as counter-revolutionary. But yeah, I mean, but it's also like you look at rural America and it is not a left-wing space right now, you know? Anyway, all of the Russian revolutionaries are, including the Marxists, and I believe Marx himself, are going to get over themselves on this issue and be like, oh, actually in Russia, the peasants can be the revolutionary class. They're allowed.
Yeah, it's funny because Marx, right, like the end of his life, he writes a letter to some of the revolutionaries in Russia where he talks about like, oh, the commune could be a basis. And then all of the subsequent Bolsheviks basically ignore him.
Yeah.
Like, nope, we need to do hyper-capitalism first to make these people proletarians and then they can be socialists. It's like, hey, guys.
Oh, we'll talk about that part. Yeah.
Oh, God.
I mean, I think that that's actually like, again, like I am not a huge Marxist. That's not my thing. I actually think that Marx was a really interesting economist who was primarily incorrect about how revolutions work. That is my take. But the one thing that I got to hand it to him, he wasn't a Marxist, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think he even said that. Doesn't he have a quote?
Yeah, it's the famous line. Yeah, it's like, if this is what Marxism is and I'm not a Marxist, and then the product of that is there's been 150 years of people calling themselves Marxians because it's not Marxist. Insufferable.
And like from my point of view, I think the thing that I respect about Marx is that on some level he was willing to take in new information and change what he believed based on new information. A huge number of people who do come from the Marxist tradition are also capable of doing that. But it's hit or miss. So, yeah, eventually the Marxists in Russia are going to get over themselves because they're like, oh, only people who are going to throw down are peasants. Not only people, but this is a peasant country, right?
Yeah.
And later in the story, you're going to have people start talking about the toilers, which the first couple times I read that, I was like, why did someone translate that word that way? I assumed that they meant worker. And they didn't. Toiler meant both the workers and the peasants. And I thought that was cool. It doesn't flow off the tongue.
Yeah. To be fair, it's better than the Maoist formulation, which is just to say workers and peasants every single time and occasionally add in students. It's like, it's funny because like most, not all, but like because of the history of the left in China, like a lot of modern Chinese leftists are still Maoist, and so you'll be reading something they write and it's mostly fine, and then they'll start talking about the student worker peasant alliance all written out like that. It's just like, oh yeah. God.
I get why it became cringy later, but I understand why Graeber and others came up with the 99% as the way to formulate this.
Yeah,
there are the people who make their money off of owning stuff, and then there are people who make their money by working. Anyway, so the SRs, back to our socialist revolutionaries, who aren't Marxists, but as soon as they form, they're like, well, we actually do want to include the workers in this revolution, the non-peasant workers. And so they start kind of bridging some gaps with Marxism and Marxists, and they do a lot of urban organizing and start recruiting urban workers as well. And overall, at the beginning, they're kind of revolutionary moderates in some ways. They are down to throw down, and they inherited some of the nihilist forebears' love of a good assassination.
Yeah.
They and the anarchists are going to be in fierce competition for how many heads of state can we put bonus holes into.
It's so good. It's so good.
But their general goals are the establishment of a republic, a socialist republic, you know, rather than like, whatever. They're slightly more moderate in some of their demands. The SRs are a really major party and they're pretty interesting. Then, I swear to God, if you all make it through me talking about Bolsheviks versus Mensheviks, we're gonna get to some people setting fire to haystacks of rich people. We will get there. You just gotta, you gotta muscle through this with us, and we promise to try and make it entertaining.
Interminable intra-party disputes, but there's a full thing.
I know, and that's actually the thing that keeps coming up. Whenever you read history books, they're always like, and then, and it's just like 18 pages of this version of the anarcho-syndicalists who are mad at that version of the anarcho-syndicalists, and I don't care. On some level, I care, because it's necessary sometimes. But overall, this is not going to be a podcast about like all of the different blow by blow and then the Mensheviks and the blah, 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 blah. I'm much more interested in the broad strokes. And I'm also, specifically with the Russian Revolution, I'm interested in how you've got these like parties, right? And then ideologies, because the anarchists aren't a party, but they're still kind of one of them. And then you got everyone doing the revolution and they're kind of not these groups. Like these are the groups that are trying to direct an organic and flowing force, but the force itself is literally made up of the people and not party politics. But I think it's still worth, everyone is always talking about the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Like I can't even stop in at Tractor Supply in town here to pick up mulch and dog food. The cashier is talking about the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Just kidding. Only sort of kidding. This is the group that will become divided between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. I'm willing to bet most people who are listening to this have heard of at least the Bolsheviks. Soon enough, like later, they're going to change their name to the Communist Party. So on some level, if I hear a random person at Tractor Supply talking shit about the communists, which hasn't actually happened, but it totally could, they actually would be talking shit about the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Because they're not talking about communism. When people say communist in the modern context, they're talking about Bolshevism primarily. Like, if the random person in America, not the random person who's like, no, I'm a Maoist or whatever. Cards on the table, as you all probably figured out, I don't really like this group very much, particularly the Bolsheviks. By the end of these episodes, you'll understand why. The RSDLP, which I guess that's not what they call themselves because that's the the English version, but whatever. The Social Democrats, they formed in 1898 in Minsk, in what's now Belarus. And their whole thing was that they wanted to import Marxism to Russia. And they were formed in a reaction to the Neo-Narodniks, the people who dared claim the peasants as a revolutionary class. And there are some good people in this group and some good groups within this group. Friends of the Pod, the Jewish Labor Bund, who do good and bad things all throughout the following thing. But so
and
do
they
the
get
anarchists.
Kicked out. But
yeah, no one's coming out of this perfect. No ideology is coming out of the Russian Revolution being like, oh, them's the good guys. But props to the Social Democratic group, the RSDLP. It's illegal right from the start.
Name.
I know, but it's illegal. So that always, you can have a crappy name, but if your group's illegal, it's got some cred. And they're like, look, I know that proletarian workers are only 3% of the Russian population, but Marx said that the urban proletariat can be the revolutionary class. So that's what we're into. In 1903, the group splits because that's what Marxist groups do.
Yeah.
I mean, so do the anarchists. We'll get to them. Well, the anarchists don't formally split. They just talk shit. But these groups formally split. They split into the Bolsheviks, which means majority, and the Mensheviks, which means minority. Here's the thing that you probably knew, but I didn't until I did this research. The Bolsheviks, masters of political propaganda, naming themselves the majority, were the smaller half.
Yep.
Do you
Great
know more
branding.
About this? I've only got like a paragraph of what
I
put together.
So, oh God, I don't remember this. There was some very specific vote that was happening inside of the party, and Lenin had like a very small majority for one vote, and he declared that now his faction was the majority. And then literally the next day, it was like, well, no, you're no longer, you don't have this majority anymore. But the name just stuck.
Yeah. I'm under the impression that they won that vote because the Jewish Labor Bund and a bunch of other people stormed out and refused to participate that day because they were so mad about it. And the vote, I believe, this particular one, was about whether or not, as the Mensheviks wanted, they would be sort of big tent with membership. And they would be like, anyone can be in this group if they like are either directly affiliated or a little bit loosely affiliated. And like, and the Bolsheviks were like, no, we need a specific tight elite group, a vanguard of highly disciplined folks, if you will.
Yeah.
And this split is more or less permanent. The Mensheviks will always be the more moderate, compromise-minded, and more democratic faction. And what they disagreed about next only makes sense if you are so Marx-pilled that you cannot see daylight. You see,
many such cases.
Oh, did they disagree about ads? That they also disagreed about whether or not this podcast should be sponsored by advertisers. But they don't have a say in it. They've all been dead for a long time, and I barely have a say in it. And here's ads.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
And we're back. Okay. The Social Democrats, Bolsheviks and Mensheviks alike, they want a revolution. They want to create socialism. And there's a science to these things. The immortal science is laid down in the Gospel of Marx. Yeah. In that understanding of the world, this is the thing that took me so long to wrap my head around, because it makes no sense if you don't come from a Marxist background. In that understanding of the world, you can't go straight from an agrarian autocratic society to a communist society. You can't even go from an autocratic urban industrial society to a communist society. First, a country has to go through a bourgeois revolution, one that leaves the rich rather than the aristocracy in charge. Like, I used to think of aristocracy as the rich, right? But it's like the aristocracy is like the nobles and shit, right? Whereas the capitalist rich are the bourgeoisie, right? Tell me if I'm getting any of this wrong, but this is my understanding.
Yeah, so like the aristocracy is specifically a feudal classes, feudal social relations. It's like kingship, your
dukes. Yeah, and the bourgeoisie is supposed to be a different class, but it isn't. Like, that's the thing. Like, in a lot of countries, like, they're just the same people. Like, this is the German experience, right? It's like most of the German bourgeoisie were just nobles.
Well, and that's one of the things that, like, and Marx was really good at figuring out the economy of England, where he, like, lived, even though he was German. But the further you get from England, the more his whole, I don't even remember the name of it. I feel like I probably can't even say it on air. The way, the Oriental.
Oh, yeah. Economy, it's called the Asiatic mode of production.
How is it? The Asiatic.
There's a Slavonic one, too, that everyone forgets. It's nonsense.
How can you forget the Slavonic mode of production?
So, gibberish.
Yeah. And so it's like, no scientist working in the 19th century, no social scientist working in the 19th century got everything right. But what we do when we care about science is we build on those things and we critique the old things and we build new things. Anyway, the social democrats are fighting to have a bourgeois revolution to put the rich in charge instead of the nobles. They are fighting to empower the wealthy to create a liberal society so that the groundwork can be laid for the people to become industrial proletarians and then seize power in the communist revolution. If you ever want to be angry, read what Engels had to say about the Irish people as relates to any of this, or really anyone who isn't English. Both the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks agreed that this was the task in front of them. But what they disagreed about so strongly that they could never work together, I mean, they do eventually work together again on some stuff, is whether or not the revolutionary class of the bourgeois revolution would be the bourgeois, or whether the peasants had to be the people to make the bourgeois revolution. The Bolsheviks were like, fuck it, we'll get the peasants. There's more of them. Like, they seem to be angry anyway. We'll have them do the revolution to empower the liberals. Whereas the Mensheviks are like, no, it's the liberals who will help the proletariat to have a revolution to empower the liberals. I fucking can't with these people.
This, it's so funny, because, so these brainworms have never stopped being a thing. I mean, there are, like, you can see this in, like, Latin American elections. You will hear people talking about how, oh, well, we need to transition from feudalism to capitalism because we never did it. Like, the Maoist Party in the Philippines, who've been doing this insurgency for, like, 50 years, their leader has an entire thing about how the Philippines is still a feudalist society and not a capitalist one because they don't have steel production. I'm not making this up. It's like this brainworm has stuck in the heads of people for hundreds of years. That's awful.
And that's why I feel the need to explore this stuff in this week's episode, because I think to understand what's going on in the Russian Revolution and modern leftism, I think understanding these underlying ideas is worthwhile, even though it's a minefield of brainworms, which is a strange and visceral image. So, next I'm going to talk about the anarchists, and they don't start where at least I expected. I don't know if they're going to start where you expected. Mia, when you think of Russian anarchists, do you think that the first Russian anarchists, when you think of them, do you think of Christian pacifist hippies?
Oh, well, yeah, because of Tolstoy.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get into it. Okay, you're smarter than I was.
Well, this is partially because, like, I think Tolstoy was one of the first people I ever realized was an anarchist, because, like, I grew up in a really, really Christian, like, community. Okay. And that was, like, the first, like, I don't know, that was, like, the first kind of thing I ran into as, like, little baby Mia.
I mean, so your trajectory is very similar to the Russian anarchist trajectory in this way. Two of the most influential theoreticians of anarchism come from Russia. Possibly the two most influential theoreticians of anarchism come from Russia, Bakunin and Kropotkin. Both of them, their heyday is over by the time we're talking about. Bakunin's heyday is over because he's been dead for 24 years by the turn of the century. He died in 1876. And his whole thing was a little bit more insurrectionary, a little bit more, you know, he was into secret societies and propaganda of the deed, and a little bit more like cloak and daggers, emphasis on daggers. Kropotkin was a biologist who studied and developed a lot of the modern concepts of mutual aid, and his work is actually still used when we talk about why animals are gay, which is like one of my favorite things in the world.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, if you read an article about scientists talking about gay animals, they're like, well, actually, Competition is only one part of evolutionary biology. And actually, this old evolutionary biologist, Peter Kropotkin, better known for his other works, you know, developed the concept of mutual aid as a factor in evolution. He wrote a book called Mutual Aid, a Factor in Evolution, which, by the way, he got a lot of those ideas by studying the natural world and then also studying and working with and living with indigenous populations in eastern Siberia. But anyway, Kropotkin's, he's a little bit, like, he's not afraid to throw down. He's not a pacifist, but he's way more like, let's change culture. Let's do things a little bit more equally. Whereas, like, Bakunin's, like, the destructive urge is also a creative urge and whatever. Kropotkin's heyday is over at this point because he's old now and he's not so involved. And he's in exile. He's living, I think, in England most of this time. Although maybe
Canada. I think this is after like a prison break and stuff. So like, it's not like he's in exile because he wasn't doing anything. It's just that he can't go back to Russia because he's gonna be
That's actually a really good point. A lot of people are gonna be like self-imposed exile. This man like circumnavigated the world.
Yeah.
After breaking out of prison. So despite anarchism as a theory largely being shaped by these Russian guys, anarchism is not a prevalent force in 19th century Russia. The nihilists absolutely rubbed elbows with Bakunin, but they were, at the end of the day, bomb-crazed social democrats. The Narodniks took some inspiration from, I believe, Bakunin and Kropotkin. I'm a little confused on this because I did most of that research about a year and a half ago. But they, too, were fighting, by and large, for something that looks a little bit more like a representational democracy or a socialist democracy. Kropotkin built a ton of the ideas of modern anarchism and mutual aid by hanging out with and observing indigenous communities in Siberia, like I was saying. He also did a lot of work to help communities escape persecution by the Tsar and like helped entire communities like find new homes in Canada and stuff, which is...
Oh, that's really cool.
I know. It is a little bit trading one colonialism for another, but it's still helping a group of people who are being persecuted get away is good, you know?
Yeah, and like, I mean, as bad as the Canadian government is, and like, I am a famous Canada hater.
Okay.
The Tsarist Russia was a worse place to be than Canada, even though Canada's colonial history is appalling. Tsarist colonialism is something else.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
It's really bad.
He saved a ton of people's lives by being like, he wasn't just like an anthropological observer being like, oh, you have this interesting mutual aid community. He was like, y'all need to get out. We kind of cribbed most of our notes from our ideology by watching you. We can help you get out. And a lot of communism is built out of the communes that serfs sometimes lived on also, right? So a lot of, I'm working on this theory. I think anarchism in Russia is a bit like anarchism in Ireland and Mexico and other colonized spaces. It's less of something that was imported to the region and more of something that people took inspiration from indigenous lifeways there. Sort of anarchic ideas were exported to the anarchists and then kind of re-imported back again. And I've seen this cycle happen with Siberia, Ireland, and Mexico, like I was saying, and it's just come up on this show specifically as I do this research. And I think it's happened a bunch of other places too. But there were absolutely a bunch of specific 19th century anarchists in Russia. And as you successfully called, and you were the only person I could have had as a guest who would have called this, they were Christian pacifists.
James might have been able to do it. James is also an anarchism knower. James is my co-host, James Stout, co-hosts on...
That's true. James would have had a chance. I wouldn't have had a chance. I would have just assumed there was a ton of anarchists among the nihilists and shit, you know? There weren't. This Christian quietism predates Leo Tolstoy. So it also predates being called anarchism. And it really hits its stride with Tolstoy and is more objectively interconnected with anarchisms at this point. The War and Peace guys who we're talking about, Leo Tolstoy, it is hard to overstate how influential he was while he was alive. These days, I know very few people who have actually successfully read any of his books.
They're really long.
They are really long and really dry.
Just read The Death of Ivan Ilyich. It's like a little novella. Get your slight Tolstoy pulled. It's really depressing, though.
Russian literature?
Yeah. Huh. Imagine that. Yeah. What a concept. But it's just, it's a little, that was like the first thing I read by Tolstoy. It was a little novella.
Okay. No, I've read some of his short stories, maybe. I read a short story that I watched a movie based on about a deserter from the army, but I don't remember the name of it.
And unfortunately, I'm an enormous nerd. And so the first Tolstoy thing that I read that was The Kingdom of God is Within You, which is his like anarchist book.
Oh, and I've just looked it up. It looks like there's a free PDF version of it online from Stanford University. So,
hell yeah.
Fucking read it for free.
Tolstoy, we're still not covering him in detail, but he has woven his way like Quakers and...
He's not quite tuberculosis, but he does come up often.
Yeah. And don't worry, I'm going to tie the industrial workers of the world in later.
I'm sure you are.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, no, I am. It's in the script. Yeah.
But first, more context.
Yeah. So Tolstoy never set out to lead anything, but people followed his teachings anyhow. And his teachings were basically violence is bad, the state is bad, private ownership of capital goods is bad, Christianity is good, anarchism is good, except when it's violent, which it is way too often. So a ton of people refused conscription, refused to pay taxes, refused to take any oaths, and like set up communes and vibed. And that's cool.
Yeah.
Vibes is good.
Good for them.
But the Russian anarchists as we know and love them today, the anarcho-communists and anarcho-syndicalists and anarcho, we don't have another adjective here. Honestly, terrorists, the anarcho-terrorists, I think this would be the thing they most likely call themselves as a third group. They start at the same time as all these other revolutionary groups, right the fuck near the turn of the century. They never form a political party per se, but they will maintain ideological and fraternal relations with each other and or disagree and talk shit on each other and even be like, oh, that group's too violent. They say, well, they're like building a bomb to go blow up somebody like. But all of the groups do that. All of the groups, the anarchists are not unique and they're like murdering people at this stage, to be clear. They are unsurprisingly a bunch of different groups and a bunch of different ideas. Most of them come out of Western Russia, parts that are no longer Russia, especially Poland and Ukraine. Specifically, and not coincidentally, they come out of the Pale of Settlement. Because in Russia, it was only legal to be a Jew in certain parts of Western Russia, a place called the Pale of Settlement. I had always assumed that this is where the phrase beyond the pale comes from, but it's not. Beyond the pale comes from a different pale, which was this area of Eastern Ireland around Dublin that had been properly colonized by the British. So beyond the pale meant the barbarian lands of the Celts.
I need to start using that differently now that I know that. It's like, oh, this is the cool part.
I know, right? Exactly. So anyway, you can't overstate how influential Jewish anarchism was, not to just anarchism, but the broader labor movement. A ton of Jewish labor Bund folks wind up anarchists, though plenty of them stay social democrats and are the enemies of the anarchists. And another one stays social democrats and work with the anarchists. And it's almost like you can't take a ethnic group and say anything particular about their character.
Yeah. Who could have guessed?
And what I find cool about this like export and then import thing, one of the main ways that anarchism is reintroduced to Russia is Yiddish language newspapers coming out of London, which also means that they were inspired by Ireland because it was the London anarchists who were picking up on Irish ways of resisting like landlordism and all that shit. I love how interconnected really all this is. Yeah. And so they're like, and they're also like specifically passing out things being like, remember the Chicago Haymarket martyrs in Ukraine and Poland in 1904, you know?
It's really incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, there is this joke about how like everyone in other countries knows about American political prisoners and Americans don't.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is to be fair, people in the U.S. did know about Haymarket, but yes, that stuff spread. Like there were riots like in Japan.
Yeah.
Over it, like it's staggering.
Well, I would argue from some level of knowledge, but not complete knowledge, the thing that I think about is about how anarchists at the turn of the century, when they didn't have they had telegraphs, I guess, but they didn't have fucking Twitter or email or reliable post, were having conversations about things happening all over the world.
Yeah.
And including American anarchists knew about all the stuff happening in Japan. You will hear about American anarchists talking about Japanese anarchists and like fighting for them at the beginning of the 20th century, right? And you don't even see that as much anymore. And it's embarrassing because like now we have like, I mean, we fucking Google Translate now, you know? I think that one of the reasons for this is that anarchism in the United States wasn't really American. It wasn't primarily English speaking, and it was an immigrant ideology. You know,
that's like my best guess. It was also, I mean, like one of the things I remember researching stuff on Japanese anarchism was, so Japanese mm-hmm. anarchism in like the 20s has this split between the syndicalists and the anarcho-communists. Yeah. And Rudolf like Rocker, who is like this really kind of famous, well, not that famous, but he's an anarchist organizer in Germany, is like writing them letters being like, please don't split. And I can't explain that purely by the sort of like...
No, totally. I think that they were just actually better at being international comrades back then.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a thing that we need to come back to, you know?
Yeah. I think another part of it was also just people would just go to play. Like a lot of Japanese anarchism came from people going to Paris and meeting a bunch of anarchists in Paris and then coming back.
Totally.
And I don't know.
No, totally. Like, especially American anarchists.
Yeah. Like those kind of like communication lines don't really happen anymore, and it's really bad.
Although part of that was because we used to get exiled constantly.
That's true. also true.
But you know, it's an election year. Anything can happen. So you've got anarcho-communists and anarcho-syndicalists who are fighting for a fairly orderly society, and they're overall focused on labor organizing. And then you've got Black Banner and other anarchists that get called anti-intellectual anarchists, or sometimes anarcho-terrorists. And when I say that they're anti-intellectual, like I was reading this whole essay about anarchism and anti-intellectualism, and I'm like, I'm really sad that they're anti-intellectual. You know how every word just means something completely different depending on the context?
Yep.
This is one of them words.
Oh, great.
They are not like, we don't like books, they're bad, burn the books, kill all the intelligentsia. Mostly. It's that they are action focused rather than theory focused, and they are opposed to having an intellectual class, and they believe that education should be broad and that every peasant and worker can become politically educated. And that's considering cool. around this time, one of the splits that's going to happen with Lenin and the Bolsheviks, actually, I think versus the Mensheviks, but I'm not entirely certain, is that Lenin is going to be like, no, fuck popular education. We need to just have the intelligentsia leaders. We need the smart vanguard. Everyone else could be a bunch of dum-dums.
Yeah, and like Lenin's whole, the working class needs to be led by middle class, like coffee shop dipshits, has had unfathomably terrible, all the most annoying people you've ever met, like that's the reason why, like this.
And so Chernoe Znamia, Black Banner, they are fighting against that. They are working class intellectuals, in as much as they're intellectuals at all. But actually, they do spend half their time talking about theory, so like, whatever. They started in what's now Poland in 1903, mostly by Jewish anarchists, but not, they were not a Jewish organization. And they had a theory. The theory was, we are currently being oppressed, but people who are dead can't oppress us. So what if we just kill the people who are oppressing us? And they set out to do it. They referred to themselves as terrorists, and they even referred to what they were doing as motiveless terror. And yet for all of that, they were fairly restrained. Although I have read two very different takes on this, both from an anarchist position, but they weren't just like wilding out on everyone. When they robbed the rich, they didn't kill unless the person didn't give them their money. and when they interfered with strikes by stabbing strike-breaking bosses to death, they only did so when all other means had been exhausted, and they did it because the striking workers would come to them and be like, hey, our strike isn't working. Could you do a little, like,
stabby?
Yeah, just like extra blood in the scene. It might help, you know? And so they considered themselves working very closely with the people. That's more the primary source version. Like, that's from a guy who was in it. Whereas, like, a later historian was a little bit like, oh, they were a little bit more marginal than... I don't know. But they also raided gun shops and barracks for arms. They bombed police stations. And they just did all kinds of shit. They and the strikes in the movement at the time that they represented included everyone from the Nityarkas, which are the lowest of the workers, the female textile workers, to students and even some soldiers. And there's also this thing that happens, and I read mostly anarchist history, so I have a bias here that could be tying into this. I read about a ton of women in these groups. Like, about a third of the names of the people that I would read, who would be like, and then this person blew up that person or whatever, are women doing those actions. And I don't see that as much in the other ideologies. However, I have not studied the other ideological factions as closely. So it is possible that I am biasing anarchistist feminism.
Yeah, I think, because I think part of what was going on is, like, if I'm remembering correctly, I think a lot of these organizations have, like, their own women's groups that are, like, another thing.
Okay.
And that's part of why the February Revolution 1917 goes the way it does, because the feminist groups are like, we're doing the revolution, and yeah, all of the normal groups are like, eh, bad day, eh, too early, and then they do anyway. The revolution.
Yeah. I'm excited to get to the 1917 stuff. Even before the revolution of 1905, which we'll get to soon, Black Banner was at war with the state. However, they were like way more marginal before 1905. They become way bigger of a deal during 1905. And they're all based out of Bialystok in Poland, which turned into something, well, they started there. They actually spread a great deal, but they started in Bialystok. Turned into something of a war zone in 1904, with fighting between the people, the anarchists, and the Tsar's forces, the police. Other anarchist groups are doing this kind of shit too, and I believe that other revolutionary groups are too. Every history book that I found is written by more or less a partisan of one of these leftist groups or the other, right?
It's a real
issue. And so they're always like, the SRs did everything! The anarchists did everything! No one did anything till the Bolsheviks did it! Or whatever, you know? But Black Banner was a really big deal, and soon it spread to the countryside and to other cities and regions. Each fighting group was largely autonomous. Their newspaper, because, yeah, of course they had a newspaper, had a masthead. And the masthead was a quote from Goethe. In the beginning, there was the deed. And I don't know enough about Goethe to say how that really ties in politically.
Me either.
Old dead guy, German. One of the main sources we have about this group, Black Banner, is this guy who probably was never himself in a fighting group, was instead one of their chief propagandists and sort of ideologues. At least according to himself, he was one of their chief ideologues.
Wow.
According to someone else, he never threw down, but I don't know. And his name is Ayuda Grossman Roshan. And the problem with him as a source, the other problem with the fucking Russian Revolution,
yeah,
is that when the Bolsheviks take charge, they literally write all the history and rewrite all the history. And so this man becomes a Bolshevik. And so in 1924, he writes about the thing that I read about Black Banner. The longest thing I read about Black Banner was from him. And it was written in 1924 after he became a Bolshevik. But half of the document is him saying, I swear I'm a loyal Bolshevik. Please don't kill me for having ever been an anarchist. I swear I know that Bolshevism is the one true way. And I swear I know that anarchism is bad. It is literally pages and pages of disclaimer. Before then, he talks about how fucking cool Black Banner was. And so my reading behind it, between the lines, is that he was a man who didn't want to die. So he joined the Bolsheviks at some point. Literally just out of not die, which I suppose is a kind of exile. He wrote about Black Banner. Groups sprang up like mushrooms after a rain in cities, villages, and hamlets. Bialystok was the organizational center, the heart of the whole movement. The groups preserved complete autonomy, but delegates were always turning up for directive of an ideological or tactical character. Another anarchist group over in Ukraine called itself the Union of Poor Peasants, which is a cool fucking name.
Yeah.
Most famous among their members is a guy who's going to become important to the story soon, a young Ukrainian anarchist named Nestor Makhno.
Hey.
During this time, he goes to jail for killing a cop. And another sick name of one of these groups is the Union of the Unreconcilable.
Wait, that's so sick. Why have we never done that one again? That's awesome.
Well, in order to live up to them, you'd have to assassinate an interior minister.
You know,
look, we could do like Andorra or something. There's got to be like, there's got to be places you can do this.
Yeah, totally.
Didn't someone kill one in Bolivia at one point?
You know, these things happen. Meanwhile, other anarchists, especially the anarcho-syndicalists, you'll be shocked to know, are decrying the terrorism. And a lot of the anarcho... And so, like, the anarcho-terrorists are like, we hate the Kropotkinites. And the Kropotkinites are like, we hate the anarcho-terrorists. And they actually... And so I read all this stuff about them fighting, but then I read first-person sources, and then they were like, oh, yeah, we're all hanging out at the graveyard, and my friend, the anarcho-Kropotkinite, was there. And I'm like... I think people try to present the anarchists of the Russian Revolution as a little bit more fractured than they were.
That makes sense.
I'm not certain. I think it's like both are true is the best I can tell.
Yeah. And I mean, something like I've ran into in like modern anarchist spaces is like you get like warring cliques, but then people are just friends with people in both cliques.
Totally. And totally.
You know,
like, you know, someone says a de Kunist, and you're like, well, we're still at the same party. Yeah, and so what the Kropotkinist anarchists are doing is that they're going to the people again, Narodnik style, and they have pamphlets with titles like How the Peasants Will Succeed Without Authority, which is kind of cool.
Based?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, you know, and the pamphlet is like, well, you kind of just keep doing what you're doing, only now there's not a noble, you know? But what there is no more script in part one. Because we didn't get to the Russian Revolution of 1905, because that's part two. But when we come back, all of these groups, they're all set up and everything's in crisis. And what's going to happen? And after you all patiently listen to the Menshevik versus Bolshevik and the anarcho-terrorist versus Kropotkinist, now there's going to be a revolution. But in the meantime, if people want to hear you talk about stuff, where can they do that?
Yeah, the podcast, It Could Happen Here, wherever fine podcasts are distributed. And I guess I'm at itmechr3 on Twitter, but I'm like trying to not be on there right now. So yeah don't Nightmare go back there. Land. Terrible place. 0 out of 10.
What if you get a blue check without asking while you're gone?
Oh God.
I saw that. Why are it's so aggressive?
I know. It's like, I swear these people like me. Much like how Lenin tried to get Kropotkin to pretend to be friends with him.
Great parallel. That's
Elon Musk. Very funny.
Yeah. So, yeah. Listen to It Could Happen Here. Listen to Cool People Did Cool Stuff next Wednesday. And also follow me on Substack at margaretkiljoy.substack.com. And I guess you can also... follow me on Twitter at Magpie Killjoy or Instagram at Margaret Killjoy. Oh, and I got to announce my new book. I have a book coming out on September 24th called The Sapling Cage, and it is a trans witch YA book. I got to write high fantasy about a girl who isn't quite sure that she's a girl. She was born a boy, but she really wants to be a witch. And so she dresses up as a girl and goes and joins the witches. And in the meantime, saves the enclosure of the commons, but magical. Because I wrote it. It doesn't say enclosure in the commons anywhere in it, and you do not need to care about Bolsheviks versus Mensheviks to read it. And it's coming out from Feminist Press September 24th. It'll be up for pre-orders probably in June. I will be talking about it a bunch because I'm very excited about it. And what else? Sophie, you got anything to plug?
I'll plug a show that's coming out on Cool Zone Media in May.
Is it 16th Minute?
It's 16th Minute, hosted by Jimmy Loftus. It is a show... that looks into the internet's weirdest and greatest characters. And it's a weekly podcast, and I'm very excited about it.
It's all about Elon Musk and how much Jamie loves. I can't even, I know.
You can't even do that as a bit.
No.
Yeah.
No, that's too mean. It's one thing to, there's been the bit of claiming that Jamie Loftus killed a man, and that's fine. But liking Elon Musk is a little bit low. I'm excited for that podcast.
It'd be so good.
See you all on Wednesday.
Bye.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.